Thank you for downloading the Pawneeville Ranch podcast, brought to you by the staff of the Pawneeville Ranch.
Welcome to the Pawneeville Ranch podcast. I'm Erin Brown, Pawneeville Ranch curator.
And I'm Anna Davis, Pawneeville Ranch historical interpreter.
Anna, winter is most definitely upon us here in Oklahoma. It's freezing cold in Pawnee, and things have really slowed down for us here on Blue Hawk Peak. Our visitation has tapered off, as it typically does in the winter, and that means we spend a little bit more time deep cleaning and organizing artifacts, and we end up doing a lot of that in one of our favorite places on the ranch, Pawneeville's Mansion.
Yeah, typically by late summer, we already have a long list of projects that we really want to tackle during the winter months when it's slower. This year, our list was filled with lots of different cleaning projects. We've scrubbed floors and baseboards, polished the front staircase, and tackled the glass and silver in the mansion. And the mansion is absolutely gleaming right now. Pawneeville's mansion has been called the jewel of the ranch, and for good reason. I know that you, as well as I, have a particular attachment to the mansion, and part of that is that the home is the embodiment of Pawneeville and May's dreams.
That's right. The home's architectural style is technically a Tudor-style arts and crafts home, and it was definitely May and Pawneeville's dream home. They built it exactly the way they wanted it, and we know that they loved their time in the home together and with Billy. Living in show tents, hotels, her parents' home, a cabin, train cars, and now, finally, in 1910, the year of their 25th wedding anniversary, they were building a proper home on their own land in their own way. It had to be enormously satisfying for the couple who had weathered so much during their marriage.
A lot of people don't realize that by the time the mansion was ever even considered a possibility, the Wild West show was actually nearly over. They had been married for 25 years by this point. In a way, the show itself and its success led to Pawneeville and May being able to afford the home as we know it now. Now, if the building of the mansion had happened at any earlier time, the house itself could have turned out completely different. The craftsman style of home was brand new in the middle part of the United States in 1910. It had been built on the East Coast and the West Coast, but it really wasn't being built in this part of America at that time. And the mansion at that time was completely innovative. Ground was broken in January of 1910 for what was termed the bungalow, and the town of Pawnee was buzzing.
Newspapers at the time reported that the house would be made of stone, with a local named Fred Uhl superintending the stonework, and that the home would command the best view of the vicinity of Pawnee. The stone was quarried from the ranch site. Much of the town of Pawnee, especially the area around the ranch, is thick with sandstone, and so that's what the exterior of the mansion is made out of. Building continued all through that year, through the summer and fall, and Pawneeville left the Wild West Show tour to return to Pawnee in June for 3 weeks to oversee a portion of the construction. The exterior and the interior of the home were designed by Uhl, the Lillys, and James Hamilton of Chester, Pennsylvania, who returned with Gordon in June to check on the work.
Now, James Hamilton is an interesting character himself. He was the main architect who designed the floor plan of the mansion. And from what we know about Mr. Hamilton, he owned a successful manufacturing business in the Philadelphia suburb of Chester. This story of Pawneeville's relationship with Hamilton goes back to 1895, when the Wild West Show wintered in Chester, Pennsylvania. It was in Chester that Pawneeville became friends with a lumberman that helped him rebuild all the damaged wagons from his European tour. Pawneeville went $10,000 in debt on hardware for the wagons. Now, debt never scared Pawneeville. He was a scrapper, and he could find the money. And when the hardware man said that he would not let Pawneeville leave town owing him money, the lumberman threatened to stop doing business with him. So Pawneeville paid the lumberman after 2 weeks on the road with the show in 1896, and his friendship with that man would last his entire life. The lumberman was James Hamilton, and he built the Lillys' dream home in 1910. By the time that he designed the mansion, he was actually a well-known box manufacturer. Manufacturing and lumber were his business, but architecture seems to be something that he did on the side. And he was fairly good at it, too, if the design of our house is any indication of his body of work.
I think this historic home will always be my favorite home because it balances beauty and luxury with the sense of nature and hominess. From the west, the home rises out of a hilltop as you wind up the road coming into the small town of Pawnee. Its red tile roof and native sandstone exterior seem to be just an extension of the landscape, which is a mixture of green hills, prairie pasture, and timber. It sits on the highest point of this area, and in 1910, the home wasn't surrounded by any trees, so the hilltop view included miles of surrounding territory.
Yeah, and it's amazing the connection that people have to a home that's 105 years old. When you hear the word mansion, you know, you get images of a large structure.
It's probably not the most correct term. It's really not a mansion, but it's what it's always been called.
Exactly. And now some mansions can be kind of large and cold and a bit unwieldy, but the way that Pawnee Mills Mansion is built kind of gives it a feeling of a cozy, intimate home. We hear from tourists all the time that they could see themselves just packing up and moving in and living in the house today comfortably. You would expect a grand, stately home to be fussy on the inside, but the mansion's interior is surprisingly simple. There are very few ornate features. There's straight, clean lines, and then you fill it with these warm, inviting colors. It's definitely a place you want to spend some time in. And this was obviously a home that the Lillys had planned to spend many years in.
Exactly. And not only was the house really beautiful and comfortable, but it was very modern on the inside. They had hot and cold running water. They had a big boiler down in their basement that powered their steam heat. They had electricity, which they powered here on the ranch. So they had electricity before the town had electricity because they had windmills and wind chargers. So it was just a really modern, innovative home.
Yeah, you have to wonder how much time they spent just thinking about what they wanted in their house.
Yeah, I think it was a lot of fun. And you can imagine that the building of this mansion made the pages of the Pawnee paper for all the months that it was being built. It really captured people's attention. And it was hard to miss this large house being built on top of Blue Hawk Peak. The mansion can be seen from many different vantage points from the town of Pawnee, and it's really kind of one of the calling cards of Pawnee.
Mm-hmm.
The construction of the house really turned into a family affair. Most of the photographs of the mansion under construction come courtesy of Garnet Lilly, Pawnee Bill's niece. We're really grateful to her. Because of her love of photography, we have wonderful documentation of the mansion while it was being completed.
Yeah, one of my favorite photographs is the workers, like, mm-hmm. on the outside of the mansion, standing on the scaffolding. There's no windows. The pretty radiators are just laying in the yard. Mm-hmm. But
we'll have to post some of these photos on our Facebook page so that you all can see some of the photographs we have in our archive of the mansion construction and of their celebration when they mm-hmm. completed it.
Yeah, now it was Pawnee Bill's intention that the magnificent yet accessible home would be the ideal place for entertainment of his friends during the winter season when the Wild West Show and Far East shows were resting up. One newspaper account likens the residence to Buffalo Bill Cody's and describes an invitation to Cody's house as an honor eagerly accepted by the greatest men of the country where they can receive hospitality of the highest kind. Pawnee Bill wanted to be in that same category as his partner was, and he wanted to be considered as generous in his entertainment, stating that it was his wish that by the holidays, a merry company of friends could be assembled under their new roof.
And Pawnee Bill achieved that dream. In December of 1910, a joyous party of invited guests arrived in Pawnee to celebrate the opening of the couple's dream home. And we have a wonderful photograph downtown of all of the people that came in to celebrate with them. And there was Buffalo Bill in town mm-hmm. and E.W. Linders, the artist, and just a lot of wonderful characters that came to the house. And all these people drove through the huge stone archway that marked the ranch entrance. And the arch itself is impressive. I just think it's a beautiful structure. It was built out of native stone, like the home, and ornamented with the initials PB and then the words Buffalo Ranch in steel. Visitors would then circle along a gently sloping hill up to Blue Hawk Peak, the site of the home. Now, this original arch still exists, but it's not part of the ranch property today. It can be seen just a little way down the road. It's privately on a privately owned lot, and it's just down from our current arch at the park entrance.
The house, of course, had a formal dining room, which was complete with modern built-ins. The china hutches in the dining room, of course, built into the walls. The house downstairs contains deep, rich Philippine mahogany woodwork. The upstairs has oak. The house at the time was electric. The hot and cold rainwater was flowing in the bathrooms in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. It had steam heat from the boiler in the basement. It had elegant inlaid patterns on the floor. And, of course, the other 14 rooms in total. Never before in their lives had the couple had the means to live in such comfort and satisfaction. You can imagine so many years on the road. They just didn't have time to sit down and plan this, but this was finally theirs. The home was the pinnacle of what they had worked towards during their partnership. It's a physical manifestation of what they wanted. And the final cost of their dream home would total close to $100,000 in 1910. Now, in today's money, in 2015, when you factor in inflation, that's equivalent to about $2.5 million.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. And a lot of what they spent their money on was quality. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's just built really, really well. The downstairs woodwork is that beautiful Philippine mahogany. It's one of my favorite things in the house. And that red-hued woodwork gives the home this warmth and this sense of coziness. And the chandeliers and cut glass really stand in this wonderful contrast to all the pottery and Navajo rugs they collected during their jaunts to New Mexico. It really was a reflection of this desire to show evidence of upward mobility and their love of the West and the Western lifestyle. It was an extension of their personalities in every way. And the home was really kind of a wonderful combination of a lot of different styles. On the inside, it had a little bit of leftover from the Victorian era. You can see in some of that in the furniture and their linens. But it was really thoroughly an arts and crafts home, and it was cutting edge and new. The home was the Lilies.
In addition to being historically significant because it belonged to Pawneeville, the home is really unique in this area, just in its architecture. It is, of course, like we said, an arts and crafts home built in the Tudor style. And there are so many different terms that are used interchangeably for this style of home. You might hear American craftsman, you might hear arts and crafts home, you might hear bungalow. They really kind of all refer to the same style. The style was completely different from the other houses of the ages. The painted ladies that were kind of fussy with their gingerbread and the Queen Anne homes, even the Gothic homes, they were all very, very different to this craftsman style. Craftsman homes embody the idea that the best things in life were handmade. The movement valued craftsmanship and hard work, and it was a cultural shift away from the mass-produced items and uniformity in building.
Right, and when we say arts and crafts, we are talking about a movement and a lifestyle. We're not talking about like the kiddie arts and crafts or paint by number or, you know, popsicle sticks. This is a whole architectural movement that lasted for many years. And it was also a philosophy of a way of life.
Yeah, many of these architects were actually designing the furniture for their homes, too. So yeah. You get like Gustav Stickley and even Frank Lloyd Wright was designing his house based on the furniture, the lifestyle, the architecture.
Mm-hmm. When we were planning this podcast, we decided to bring in someone who knows a lot about arts and crafts homes. Kathy McKinnis, the secretary of the Friends of the Pawneeville Ranch Association and director of the Pawnee Public Library, has spent many years studying the arts and crafts movement. And we thought it would be a lot of fun to interview our local aficionado, and here she tells us a little bit about why she's drawn to the style and how the style developed.
The arts and crafts movement was basically, it began as a philosophy, and it did begin in England in the last quarter of the 1800s. William Morris was the man who was the recognized beginner of that. It was intended to be a different lifestyle than the Industrial Revolution lifestyle that the people had at that time. The Industrial Revolution caused there to be the issue. It was an issue between quantity and quality. And as the Victorian age got fussier and fussier, things began to be less quality. These people that were involved in this began to speak out about the difference in how their lives had been perhaps when they were younger and how it had progressed, and they didn't think it was a positive progression at all. And around 1890, there were beginnings of Americans that would go to England and they had feelings about this same philosophy. Gustav Stickley, very, very well known for his arts and crafts, plans, and furniture here in America. One of the other names in the early arts and crafts in America was Elbert Hubbard. He had the Roy Crofters facility in East Aurora, New York, and it was basically an artist's colony. And he was a publisher as well. Many of these people were. There were several names, but those are probably the biggies to begin with. And they came and brought that philosophy back to America and then applied it.
When a lot of people think about arts and crafts architecture, they automatically think of Frank Lloyd Wright. And he was definitely one of the most famous proponents of this particular style. But there were a lot of lesser known artists and builders who embraced arts and crafts as well. And who can blame them? The style is beautiful, and the idealism behind it is really wonderful. The desire to create aesthetically pleasing buildings and furnishings that would also be functional and that would improve the lives of craftsmen drove the movement.
Right, and as you and Kathy discussed, the movement was brought about in England by devout social reformers in direct response to the character of mid-Victorian manufactured product. Of course, by this point, the Industrial Revolution had happened. Most of these things were being mass-produced in factories. And these reformers not only disapproved of the machine-age products that were being made, but also how they were being made. They protested the conditions of the workers. These workers were being mistreated. And some of the most noted reformers were William Morris, John Ruskin, and A.W.N. Pugin.
Now, every town in America has these craftsman homes, and they vary a little bit in style depending on what region of the country. I know on the West Coast, there's California craftsmen. But they all have some really similar styles, and they're pretty easy to spot. So let's listen to a little bit of our discussion with Kathy as she gives us some identifying features to look out for when you want to identify an arts and crafts home. Kathy, can you tell us a little bit about the exterior characteristics that are typical of an arts and crafts style home?
Probably the first one that is almost always left, no matter what kind of a change the house goes through the years, are the brackets that appear to be holding up the roof. They aren't, but they look like they are. They come from just under the eaves of the house, and they attach to the side, and they do indeed look like they're holding up the roof. They are, however, a decorative item in most cases. They're a little bit more difficult to remove, so people tend to leave those. Another one of the things is exposed rafter tails. This comes just from the roof as they're building, and it comes down. Oftentimes, those over the years have been camouflaged. They might have a rain gutter in front of them.
Oh, I see.
Or they could actually have been faced with a more permanent fix. They tend to think they're dressing the house up
right,
a little bit more.
Right. It's a shame because it kind of ruins the traditional arts and crafts characteristics.
It does. And of course, the porches. Again, the porches are absolutely arts and crafts without a doubt. Pawneeville's has the most beautiful porches. Three vistas, three sides of the house. Wonderful porches.
So in an arts and crafts home, does the porch typically run the entire length?
Oftentimes, the ones that are at the front of the house particularly are the entire width of the house.
Okay.
That was intended to be an extended living space.
Okay.
Something that you don't see all the time, but there actually are some here, even in Pawnee, are pergolas. Pergolas were an additional living space that were usually in the side yard or in the backyard. They look like just a frame, but they were like an arbor. They were intended to have a planting in the spring and summer. Something would grow up over the top and shade that area also for an additional living space.
Okay,
again,
so people could go out and entertain or read or have their tea or snacks or whatever out there. Okay, that's really interesting. And when they're usually constructed out of wood?
Yes.
Like these to match the home?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and they were just a freestanding structure. And
interesting.
They don't look like much unless they have something growing
on
them. And
right.
Then you can't see them.
Right.
Most of the time, the thinking was that anything inside the home should be part of the home. There were pieces of furniture that were specifically made for the homes. They were intended to be a permanent part of the home. That was also true with aesthetics as far as art, particularly art. They had very specific places they were to live. They were designed that way, and they were to stay that way. Pawneeville's have these wonderful mosaics in the living room and the den over the fireplaces and on the front porch. The material that was used to make those mosaics is arts and crafts pottery. Pottery that was used in those mosaics has a special dead glaze. It's not shiny. It's very sedate. Very low key. The colors are a little odd. Again, those same odd colors. The companies that made the pottery per se also did wall designs and things. That was very accepted in that part of the house. We think they're so wonderful, but in arts and crafts houses, other places, they exist as well.
It's pretty typical to have that built-in mosaic.
It was intended to be a permanent part of the structure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not something you just move from one room to the other as you chose.
And when I also think of arts and crafts, furniture and style, I think very clean, like clean lines. And I don't know why I think that. Is that, I guess, because of mission?
Well, that's the appropriate way to think that.
Okay.
It was intended to be, again, easy to take care of.
Mm-hmm. Not fussy.
Not fussy. No fussiness at all. Most of the time, draperies were made out of linen. They were panels, very, very geometric,
okay,
feeling, things like that. And that was the intent. Mm-hmm. It was that way.
So an uncluttered.
Very uncluttered. Very uncluttered. Very clean, but structured.
We have many interviews and newspaper articles where Pontybell refers to his home as a bungalow. And that's a pretty typical term when we think of arts and crafts homes. It was part of the vocabulary that people talked about when they refer to homes as bungalows, but that's not entirely accurate for Pontybell's mansion. How would you describe his home correctly?
Pontybell's home is a Tudor-style semi-bungalow arts and crafts home. A second story on the home made it a semi-bungalow.
So a one-story home would have been a true bungalow.
Correct.
But because this has the additional second
story,
it's a semi-bungalow.
It really isn't a bungalow.
In Pontybell's home, we see a lot of Western influences. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, one of the design additions when people were doing interiors of the arts and crafts homes, very often they used art and articles from Native American peoples. And of course, Pontybell has some wonderful examples of Native American things in his home.
Right. So American Indian crafts would have been a very trendy thing to have in a very modern arts and crafts home. Mm-hmm. But we know that Pontybell had a real appreciation for Native culture and craftsmanship, and he collected it just personally. So it did fit in well with the style, but it was an extension of both of their loves. And I think that's one of the cool things about the house is you've got this cut glass next to teepee charms, teepee ornaments, next to a beautiful Victrola, next to Navajo rugs. I mean, it's just this wonderful mishmash of all the things that they appreciated.
We need to remember that even though it was not a Victorian home, May was a Victorian woman. She was raised in that time. There are some things about the house that probably she had a little bit of an influence in. We need to think about the fact that the downstairs where the bedrooms are, that's a Victorian suite.
Right. She probably came to this area with an idea of what was grand. She probably had in her mind an idea of what was fancy. And so that probably translated to certain elements
certain
of the home.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, I would love to say that the home was filled with Mission Oak furniture. Of course, it's not. I would think perhaps part of the home furnishings have actually probably come from the Sears and Roebuck catalog at
the
time.
And they did.
You know, being at the time they were building the house, there was not very much here as far
exactly.
as being able to
shop. They couldn't just go to the local store and buy typical arts and crafts furniture.
No.
They couldn't do that.
Probably couldn't get very much of any furniture locally.
Right.
It all had to be moved here from somewhere else.
Right. And the house is an arts and crafts home, but there are definitely elements of it that aren't a true reflection of the movement or of the design.
It's a true reflection of their personality.
Exactly. It's a true reflection of them. Well, thank you so much, Kathy. That's a really, really good explanation for what our listeners can look for when they're trying to identify arts and crafts houses out there in their own neighborhoods
and
when they travel.
They'll be there. Pontybell's is one that was built in the true time when these were actually being built in the East Coast and West Coast, whereas mm-hmm. most of the ones we have here in Oklahoma are 20 years later.
I see. So it was kind of one of the very first constructions in this area of a true arts and crafts home.
Absolutely.
So if somebody's interested in learning more about arts and crafts, where would you direct them, Kathy?
Well, you can come down to the Pawnee Public Library. I would love to talk about this. There are lots of nice reference books out. You have to be careful how you don't end up learning how to make flower pots out of soup cans. there's arts and crafts, and then there's arts and crafts. So you have to be a little bit careful about that. But there's all kinds. You know, pick a place in the United States, type the name of that town in, and then see if they have any arts and crafts homes.
And occasionally, you know, we have people who come in the house and they really want design plans. Mm-hmm. So can people order? You know, we're not going to give anybody the plans for Pawneeville's mm-hmm. mansion, mm-hmm. but can someone go somewhere and order arts and crafts
actually
plans?
There are a lot of books. I happen to own two of the Stickley books, and one of the homes actually in one of the books looks a great deal like Pawneeville's home from the outside. It's also a Tudor style. Mm-hmm. But these books they've been around a while, but they are basically just books of house plans. They happen to be arts and crafts house plans that were, that were designed in 1900. In the middle to late 1980s and into the 90s, the craftsman style was really hot. There were magazines. There are still magazines. The American Bungalow magazine is still published today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Now, this is definitely a great time to come to the ranch and take a tour through the mansion. We're slower this time of year, and the chances that you would get a private tour are pretty good. Now, these private tours are really kind of fun because you get information you've never heard before, and you might get to see some things you've never seen before.
Yes, and as we mentioned at the top of our podcast, the mansion is sparkling. I love it right now. We've cleaned the chandeliers and all the cut glass and silver, so when you enter the dining room, it really makes this beautiful impression.
You can rearrange some rooms.
We've even rearranged some rooms.
If you've come here multiple times in the past, you might be a little bit surprised to see what we've done.
Okay, so Anna, let's play pretend.
Okay.
If you could build your dream home, what would it be? Just for fun. See, I because of years working in the mansion, but also recognizing like the need for a more open floor plan, which one of the reasons I love Craftsman Home is because they really did have, beginning of the flow of the open concept where rooms, especially the dining room and the living room, flowed one to another. I would love an arts and crafts style home, a modern craftsman. That's what I would want. A modern craftsman home where you had like the kitchen, dining room, living room, all one. But I am a sucker for a big porch. I love big porches. I love a lot of the architectural detail, the built-ins. I love the colors, the use of rock and wood and Craftsman homes. So I would have to say modern Craftsman.
I think the architectural style that people here in Oklahoma will identify with are the Craftsman, because mm-hmm. there are so many of them.
And they're mostly one story. Pawneeville's is different because it's a semi-bungalow, the two-story.
Story, yeah. The bungalows, of course, had the big porches that wrapped around, and they were a little bit cheaper to build. So that's why you see so many of them here in Oklahoma, especially. I have a special place in my heart for colonial style houses.
Yeah.
I love colonial styles. I love the painted lady. I like the fussy style.
You like fussy.
I love the fussy
styles.
See,
I'm more of a rustic kind of girl.
Yeah. Now, here at Pawnee, we don't have very many painted ladies.
No,
I only
we don't.
Really know of one here in town. But
There's a couple,
but I love the painted lady style, which you don't really see a whole lot here. I guess I'm a fussy kind of person. So.
You're really a girl at heart.
Oh, yeah.
We hope Pawneeville and May would be proud, and our listeners should be proud too, because your support helps us to maintain the mansion and the ranch.
Well, we thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoy this podcast, and we'll be back next month with more Pawneeville history. I'm Anna Davis.
And I'm Erin Brown. Until next time.
The Pawneeville Ranch is owned and operated by the Oklahoma Historical Society. For more information, go to www.pawneevilleranch.com or find us on Facebook under Pawneeville Ranch and Museum.